Maud, a pigot. Maud, a pigot, was born in England, traveled to India several times, but ultimately settled down in Hollywood, California, where she passed away on 19th of August 1974 at 87. She joined contemporaries such as Douglas Ainslie, Grant Duff, Sunyata Anagarkia Govinda, Pauline Noe, W.Y. Evans Wentz, who also earlier in life had had some association with Bhagavan Ramana, and for one reason or another migrated to or lived in California. At that time, California was an incubator for spiritual discovery and intellectual openness that attracted scores of seekers looking for new approaches to inner and outer fulfillment. Records show that in the beginning of January 1935, she first visited the ashram for a few days and then returned from Madras before the end of the month and prepared for a longer stay. That is when she befriended an American visitor, Y.W. Evans Wentz, the Tibetan translator of The Life of Milarepa, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and other works. They discussed spiritual matters, and she took courage from him to question Bhagavan further until she was satisfied. Dr. Evans Wentz himself asked many pertinent questions, especially useful for Westerners seeking enlightenment. Fortunately, these questions and answers, much of Maud Pigott's dialogues, were diligently recorded in talks with Sri Ramana Maharishi for posterity. While living in California in 1967, a friend of Maud Pigott gifted her a subscription to The Mountain Path. She was delighted with the journal, and when she saw the request to send to the publisher any reminiscences readers may have had with the Maharishi, she immediately responded in 1968 with a fascinating article that was published in January 1970. It was also published the same year in Vedanta and the West, a journal of the Ramakrishna Order in Southern California. The Mountain Path article was prefaced with the following. This article relates to visits made to the ashram of Sri Ramana Maharishi in the years 1932-33. Since that time, there has been a continual flow of visitors from all parts of the world. This entailed much outward alteration, and many changes have taken place. This presents some confusion regarding the dates of her visits, the dialogues and individuals she mentions in her article were recorded in talks with Sri Ramana Maharishi to have taken place in January-February 1935. In a letter sent in 1970 to the publisher of The Mountain Path, she graciously writes, "This is just a note to thank you so very much for your sympathetic editing of the reminiscences of our dear Maharishi that I sent you a while ago and which you printed in the last number of The Mountain Path, January 1970, page 4. You gave all the essentials pertaining to the Maharishi and left out all the frills. One thing I would like to mention, not important, but just to set the record straight. It was Dr. Evans Wentz, who was at the ashram at the same time I was. We had many pleasant talks. Paul Brenton was the man who told me about the Maharishi after I had read his book, A Search in Secret India, in 1932. That sparked me to go in search of myself. That was many years ago, and yet it seems like yesterday. Again, thank you for your kindness and trouble. Maud A. Piggott, Hollywood, USA. Since she was very clear about the identity of the American she met at the ashram, Dr. Evans Wentz, and he appears to have first visited Bhagwan only at the beginning of 1935, we must infer that the dates in the preface may be in error. Maud Piggott writes in her article, "I had visited India before, but this was my first trip off the beaten track, staying with friends or in the luxurious hotels of Bombay and Calcutta, provided me with modern conveniences, can give little indication of the conditions to be met with when leaving the highways. But this was an adventure in a car, and nothing else mattered. For some years, it had been my wish to meet one of the real holy men of India, but so far it was a vain one. I had, it is true, spoken with a few saintly men and also some fakirs of the mediumistic type who were no doubt sincere enough in their way, but they were not what I was seeking. Then I was told of Sri Ramana Maharishi, and even from the little I heard, I knew I would travel anywhere and put up with any inconvenience in order to reach him. The friend who gave me the welcome news of his existence offered to take me to him. And so we arrived at Thiruvannamalai late one afternoon. We put up at the not-too-clean accommodation, the Dak Bungalow or Traveler's Rest House, which is all that is offered to the wayfarer who strays from the cities. No bedding is provided, and there is seldom much furniture, but we left my servant to wrestle with such details and made our way to the bazaar and then up to the ashram in a cart drawn by a pony. The end of our drive found us somewhat battered but full of expectation. Several of the people living in the ashram, mostly devotees, came out to greet us. Amongst them was the younger brother of the Maharishi. He was dressed in the ochre robe, denoting a sannyasin, one who has renounced the world. The other were not strictly monks in the Western sense of the word, nor is an ashram a monastery. It is a place where people wishing to study or follow a spiritual life may live. Often there are no orders or binding rules, and anyone can come and go as he pleases. Even women do not allowed to sleep on the premises or welcomed. Most of the people spoke English and greeted me in a most friendly manner. I was nervous, having been told that I was the first European woman so far to visit the Maharishi, or Maharshi, as he is generally called. We were then taken in at once to see the holy man, and after making the Indian salutation by holding the two palms together and raising them thus joined to the forehead, we laid our offerings on the ground before him. He was seated on a divan upon which was spread a large leopard skin. In front of the divan, sandal sticks were burning and a small brazier of coals on which a special kind of incense was constantly being thrown. About a dozen people were present in the hall. They spoke in low tones to one another, and a child prattled to his mother. But soon these sounds ceased, and there was quiet. I sat cross-legged on the floor with the others, though a chair had been thoughtfully provided for me. Corresponding to her arrival in the hall on that day, in talks with Sri Ramana Maharishi, the following was recorded on 6th of January 1935. Mrs. M. A. Piggott, an English lady who had read Search in Secret India, came to see the Maharishi. The services of a disciple as interpreter were provided. There were many visitors at the time in the hall, including some ladies with their infants. The place resounded with noise. At length, silence prevailed. Suddenly, Maharishi, who seemed to be looking at infinite space, was heard to say softly, "Monkey." A little baby was then discovered in the doorway and observed by the mother, who was seated on the other side of the door with a large monkey standing on his hind legs, who with both hands was fondling the child, not hurting it in the slightest, but being at peace with each other in Maharishi's presence. When Maharishi's voice was heard, the monkey jumped away adroitly and disappeared. The incident greatly impressed the lady. In her article, she goes on to describe what appears to be an initiation by look from the Maharishi. And it did seem to bear fruit soon, as testified to by the following question she asked the Maharishi on 4th of February, 1935. "Devotee, thoughts cease suddenly, then I rises up as suddenly and continues. It is only in the feeling and not in the intellect. Can it be right, Maharishi?" "It is certainly right." Mrs. Piggott wrote more than 30 years later in the article contributed to the mountain path. In her article, she describes what transpired while first sitting before the Maharishi. "For a while, nothing happened. I tried to concentrate my mind. Suddenly, I became conscious that the Maharishi's eyes were fixed on me. They seemed, literally, like burning coals of fire piercing through one. They glittered in the dim light. Never before had I experienced anything so devastating. In fact, it was almost frightening. What I went through in that terrible half hour, in a way of self-condemnation and scorn for the pettiness of my own life, would be difficult to describe. Not that he criticized, even in silence, of that he was incapable. But in the light of perfection, all imperfections are revealed. To show how little responsible he was for my feelings, he told me later on that doubting, self-distrust and self-depreciation are some of the greatest hindrances to the realization of the reality." Presently, the Maharishi got up and went for his evening walk. This was the signal for a general exodus, and we all trooped outside. The first question that Mount Piggott put to Bhagavan clarifies, perhaps, more than any other statement recorded on the subject of the role of the Guru in the spiritual fulfillment of the disciple. She asked, "Is a master necessary for realization?" And the Maharishi answered, "The realization is the result of the master's grace more than teachings, lectures, meditation, etc. They are only secondary AIDS, whereas the former is the primary and the essential cause. It is curious why Mrs. Piggott's counter question to Bhagavan and the reaction to it in the hall was not recorded in talks. Maybe the recorder was absent, or perhaps the counter question was not deemed sufficiently respectful to be worthy of recording. Nevertheless, it did demonstrate an endearing quality of the master, which few conversations have done. In her 1968 article, she wrote about the following dialogue. I asked the Maharishi, is it necessary for spiritual attainment to have a guru or spiritual teacher? The Maharishi ordered a certain treatise to be read, in which it was stated that as in all physical and intellectual training, a teacher or instructor is sought, so in matters spiritual, the same principle holds good. And he added, it is hard for a man to arrive at a goal without the aid of such a one. I turned to him, but you had no guru. A rustle of shocked horror ran through the hall, but the Maharishi was not in the least disturbed by my audacious remark. On the contrary, he looked at me with a twinkle in his eye. Then he threw back his head and gave a joyous, wholehearted laugh. It endeared him to me as nothing else could. A saint who can turn the laugh against himself is a saint indeed. To be continued.